Today we have Ben Chapman. Ben has worked in Australian politics for the past 10 years, and during that time he has also studied and researched the expression of Australian identity in film and what it can tell us about the broader Australian society. So you currently work for a newspaper?
Union.
A union?
Health services.
Our nice union man here. So he wrote an article on Australian filmic mining mythology for studies in Australasian cinema and presented on the same topic at Hands in Brisbane last year. So welcome, Ben.
I did this research in my honours thesis, and I spent about a year and a half kind of mucking around with it and updating it and getting reviewed for publication, and added quite a bit to it in that period. When I presented it last year, I was actually presenting it. The chair of my session was the academic who I was arguing with, so that was awesome. And she was, like, smiling back at me as I was kind of reading out these criticisms of her work, which was, like, it's just a terrible experience. But she was very nice in the end and kind of acknowledged various things about what I was saying. But, look, there's a few clips that I'm going to show. I'll start off by saying I don't actually think either of the two films that we're discussing are actually that great. I think they're actually not particularly good films for a lot of different reasons. When I started doing the research and started looking at Japanese story, it was a film that I'd always kind of liked. But as I kind of delved into it and read some other kind of criticisms about the way that it kind of marginalised, there's a great article called The Sacrificial Asian in Australian Cinema, which is really good by Olivia Koo, an academic in, I think, at Monash, that starts off the kind of criticism of kind of how Australian cinema treats other cultures. And then when I came across Australian Cinema After Mabo, which focuses on Japanese story a little bit but also writes a lot about other Australian cinema, including Rabbit Proof Fence, which is another film that I really don't like, was kind of singing a lot of glorious praises of it. So I thought I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to try and pull apart and understand exactly why I don't like the various things that are kind of being expressed by academics when they're writing about Australian cinema, why at that time when I was writing and doing my initial research in 2011, why Australia, the film, got to be the subject of an entire academic conference when it's like literally a terrible Australian film, in my view, and not something that we should be aspiring to or, you know, spending a lot of time kind of delving into. And, you know, through the course of the research in my thesis, I kind of chose to not focus on Australia and other films, but the broader kind of context of my research is really just about how, A, there's a lot of terrible Australian film being made, some of it's being very successful, a lot of it's getting a hell of a lot of money, but then on the critical kind of side of it and the academic side of it, there's a lot of people writing about it as though it deserves to be written about. And I don't think that's true. Anyway, that's the preamble to the paper. I've got some clips that we can just kind of go through. If people have got to leave or whatever, you know, go nuts. I'm not going to go through either of the films. I'm going to show one kind of extended piece of Red Dog, which is really, I don't know, has anyone seen Red Dog? Yeah, it's not really worth.
They show it at like 10 o'clock on Channel 9, like every other Saturday night.
Yeah. Hopefully, by the end of this paper, you will realise that you don't need to see Red Dog. You can just watch the few clips that I've got. I included one specifically to kind of give you an idea of how terrible it is in my kind of view on a lot of levels. It's not the worst film in the world, and Kruv Stenders is a great director who's done some really good other films. But anyway, I'll start off. So my paper's about the relationship that mining has with the oldest of Australia's colonial mythological tropes, the land in the sense of its geographic enormity, its visual beauty, its literary description, its filmic depiction, the relationship it had with the imaginations from the old and new worlds who created Australian colonial mythology, and the relationship that mythology has with the identities of 21st century Australians in general. Exploring it through two films, Red Dog, Japanese Story, they're basically recent examples of films about the desert landscape and mining. Those are the kind of central backdrop kind of themes, the environments in which the films are played out in. They both offer key insights into the function of mining and desert mythology in 21st century Australia. And my paper examines the evolution of Australian mythology as it relates to mining and film. However, at the end, I contextualise it, spend a bit of time contextualising it in terms of economic and political kind of spheres to kind of try and take it outside of a narrow kind of focus. Just look at how these things function in other areas and what the whole thing can kind of tell us about culture and film and politics. When I'm talking about the culture, I got into a lot of trouble with my supervisor about this. Defining culture is really difficult, but the best way I could kind of come up to describe it is it's the culture created by the diasporas who arrived in Australia with British settlement. It forms the basis, that culture forms the basis for an idea of Australianness that emerged in the 20th century. I'm not actually that interested in that formation, but rather the idea of Australian identity that emerged out of it and the interaction that that kind of identity has with the tropes that the set of tropes has with films that seek to identify, define Australian identity in the 21st century. So it's kind of fundamentally about a once-removed kind of cultural study of how our film is, film of the 21st century, is interacting with the tropes of film and kind of culture from the 20th century, blah, 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 blah. So Ross Gibson's book, South of the West, Post-Colonialism and the Narrative Construction of Australia, outlines the formation of colonial landscape mythology from pre-colonial imaginings. I'll just spend a bit of time kind of giving a basic sketch of that, even though I'm sure you're probably aware of the basics of it. He charts the evolving ideas of Australia from initial conception as the last practicable site for a European utopia, followed by a mythology born out of the failure of this initial idea as the barren centre of the continent was uncovered. The failure became the defining moment in the history of colonial Australian society and spawned a mythology of the Australian outback as a challenge to and mythological dreamscape for Australian society. Writing in 92, Gibson states, in so many ways, the majority of Australian films have been about the landscape and that such films all engage with the dominant mythology of white Australia. Landscape's a central and evolving idiom of that kind of film, you know, the visual kind of landscape. Gibson methodically charts the creation and evolution of colonial Australian myths of identity and their relationship with the land. His work concludes, written in the 90s, precisely when this culture was ceasing to be the primary and largely unchallenged contributor to dominant national mythology, so in the early 90s. He identifies at the time of writing that the myths that he's catalogued are beginning to change with Australian society. So his work, I think it's some of the best work on Australian cultural mythology going around anyway, particularly visual and kind of screen culture. I think there's a lot of stuff that's been written, but that book, as I was kind of searching through all of the different things that have been written, just so succinctly kind of defines so many things. You could read in about 10 pages what other people have written books to kind of describe. So I think there's a difference between Gibson's description of the Australian landscape and the industrially populated landscapes of Japanese Story and Red Dog. Examining the differences and similarities these films have to Gibson's description of landscape mythology helps identify the ways in which 21st century Australia is relating to the primary colonial narratives that have served in some part and continue to serve as a justification for its existence and presence on the continent. I always wanted to drink red wine while I was giving a presentation. There's been some really good work at critically kind of pulling apart Australian film from the kind of from that kind of period from the 50s through the 70s and maybe even into the 80s as well. And someone called Anne Hickling Hudson, who wrote an article called "White Construction of Black Identity in Australian Films About Aborigines" in 1990, was like, you know, was really once again quite an amazing kind of guide for me in setting up some of the deconstruction that I wanted to do. But basically her article identifies and examines the operation of the contradictory discourse of white, this is her quote, but it's the contradictory discourse of white liberalism, which is capable of condemning and at the same time perpetuating racism and racist stereotypes and one in the same artistic mode. So if you go back to, she basically looks at all of these films from like The Chan of Jimmy Blacksmith, Walkabout, a whole bunch of films from that kind of era of Australian cinema, and kind of just says, look, hey, it's great that Indigenous characters have agency, it's great that they have central kind of place within Australian film storytelling and other storytelling, but at the same time, it kind of creates another set of equally kind of disenfranchising stereotypes that, you know, Indigenous people have no control over. It's still other people who are writing and telling those stories and putting them in a different place, perhaps, and perhaps a more positive place than the one they were in, you know, or their absence completely, but still is a problem. I should have read the bit that I wrote rather than go off the thing. But look, the Australian theorists who write about it more recently, the most notable of those is Felicity Collins and Therese Davis, and their book Australian Cinema After Mabo. They explore the evolution of traditional elements of Australian mythology and film by looking at them through the prism of social and political change. Their concept for analysis is called backtracking and describes a filmic process of recasting old narrative tropes. They describe backtracking as a going over of old ground in Australian national cinema, which reprises and at the same time retracts some of the seemingly intractable figures of Australian national identity. Their readings using the concept of backtracking suggest that new Australian film is beginning to recognise, accept, investigate Australian colonial history and give recognition to Australia's new multicultural social makeup, which is really positive and great. But in my view, some of their conclusions are problematised. I don't think they give proper consideration to elements of new Australian film that do not fit with this narrative of recognition and acceptance. Their analysis of Australian film more broadly focuses too heavily on the content of a film whilst not properly considering audience engagement or box office. And I think this is particularly problematic when evaluating the relative cultural impact of film products. So, I mean, I guess that it's an interesting kind of discussion point, which I think, I don't know who agrees or doesn't agree, but I think that cultural kind of relative audience engagement is like really quite key to kind of understanding the cultural impact of something. Like, you can't just say that a film that exists in Australia, if it talks about something, that means that the country or the cultural kind of milieu of the country is, you know, that it forms a constituent part of it. If something that is the exact opposite, that had an audience that's 50 to 100 times the size of that piece of film, you shouldn't weight them equally in kind of your consideration. And it's hard to kind of prove one way or the other or talk about it in, you know, saying this is definitely means this or it doesn't mean that. But you have to be able to provide some kind of, draw a bit of a line, I think, because I think there's a lot of really good Rolf de Heer films and stuff that nobody watches that if you evaluated cultural product equally, you would say, well, what a great understanding of Indigenous kind of life in Australia the Australian community has or the cultural milieu have, because Rolf de Heer is being funded to make films, but, you know, other films as well. But so I kind of looked at some of the films that they analysed in the late 90s, and then looked at like films like The Dish and stuff like that, which were so popular compared to anything else that was getting made around that period in the late 90s. And so The Dish is like completely like nothing. It's like a complete kind of cultural void in terms of any of the kind of looking at multicultural, you know, any emerging multicultural Indigenous voices. And their kind of analysis of it was, well, it means nothing, because, you know, it didn't win an AFI award. And I was kind of like, well, it means something because 20 million people watched it. So obviously they enjoyed it on some level. So, but in terms of my paper, I kind of just went into Japanese story and kind of had a bit of a, went through their analysis of Japanese story and kind of deconstructed it a bit. So we'll get into some clips in a sec. But for those of you who, well, who's seen Japanese Story? That's better. It's not as bad as Red Dog by any stretch of the imagination. It's a story of a love affair between Australian geologist Sandy, Japanese mine owner Hiramitsu in the Pilbara region in northwestern Australia. It's got a linear narrative with three acts. The first is the establishment of the story where the main characters are introduced and have their initial interaction. The second is where the characters get to know each other and begin a sexual relationship. And the third is where the character Hiramitsu dies and his body is returned home to Japan. The film represents a transformation of some traditional conceptions of the Australian, Australian landscape and a continuation of others. And I'll just show you this kind of clip of about Yeah, so I'll just show you the opening sequence of this now, just to give you a bit of a feel for the film if you haven't seen it. There's a couple of things in that little sequence, I suppose. The first is that initial kind of title sequence, which is quite a traditional kind of representation of the landscape. It's like, oh, wow, look at the landscape. There's patterns in there that you would think might be art. That's like quite a traditional kind of conception of as nature and the landscape as being some kind of form of abstract art, but also something that was obviously quite unhuman. And then also, I guess, what Gibson kind of describes it as is as the way that white sensibility has always seen the landscape as an empty space devoid of inhabitants, architecture, agriculture and artefacts. And the second kind of section is just to note for a little bit later in that we'll get back to a discussion of this idea of basically Collins and Davis basically argue that playing treaty in the song is like really important to kind of inserting the idea of Indigenous land rights and an understanding of that right into the film. And so I just wanted to show you that scene because I think it's actually quite telling that he actually switches the song off and starts playing his own kind of, you know, cultural kind of music, you know, because he's kind of sick of it. But the other thing that the film does is use the desert for as a setting for a cross-cultural love affair between Sandy and Hiramitsu, which demonstrates what's another kind of traditional conception of the landscape. In the film, the outback is an uncomplicated space where social conventions concerning love and intimacy can be put to one side. A married man can have an affair here. A business relationship can turn into a romantic one without normal social constraints. And it's this freedom that allows the affair to blossom and creates a dichotomy between the intensity of Sandy's feelings about Hiramitsu's death and what she should be feeling back in the world where the affair in the desert can't be openly acknowledged. There's nothing inherent, and this is Gibson's conception as the desert or the landscape as being a canvas on which a created world can be presented. There's nothing inherent about the desert that makes it a place where normal social constraints can or can't operate. It's just that it can be whatever you want it to be. It can be a place where they do or they don't operate, and that is, in that way, it's blank. It's a blank space. The film also, apart from that little playing of treaty, has no presence of any Indigenous people in it whatsoever. And, of course, there are current and, you know, previous Indigenous populations in the landscape that the film takes place on. I think anyone who pays any attention to Indigenous land rights over mining would be aware enough of that. But there's just none at all. So how they read the film as being conscious of Indigenous dispossession and spiritual presence in the land is beyond me, but they do. They talk about treaty. They say that the film's post-Mabo consciousness is marked by Hiramitsu's sampling of Australian music on CD with Yothu Yindi's treaty playing in the hire car as he photographs his own estranged presence in the emptiness of the Australian outback. I would say that playing the song marks the film as being temporally present in a post-Mabo era where there's issues there, but it doesn't do anything more than that. It doesn't have any other special consideration besides that. In the third act of the film, Sandy engages in a powerful performance of grief that relates to the death of Hiramitsu. So Collins and Davis establish the performance of grief as being one of the most powerful elements of the film, and their analysis is that the grief takes place within the landscape and acknowledges the violent events that have occurred there in the past. They write that Sandy, which is, we'll meet Sandy in a second, but she breaks a pattern in Australian cinema, overcoming the tradition of tight-lipped resistance to the indulgence of those painful emotions which must accompany full acknowledgement through sustained grief of the injustices endured by Indigenous Australians. The task of the final act of the film is to show how Sandy's embodiment of grief opens up the possibility of reparation between antagonistic cultures. This attempt at translation takes place in the context of an inward-looking post-Mabo sense of Australian nationhood. Their analysis is not completely kind of incorrect in some ways that they talk about it. Like, there's the hero in the landscape, there's this kind of feminization of the hero in the landscape character, there's a kind of 21st century economic kind of development, but I don't think it's their contextualization of the grief is out of step with the conception of the land that the film presents. So for me, there's no evidence to suggest to suggest that the experience of grief is anything more than an expression of grief for her lover who suddenly and tragically died at the end of the film. The story, to me, is a modern-day fantasy that takes place in a landscape empty of any Indigenous presence. This is despite the existence of past and present Indigenous populations. So they acknowledge that the story doesn't confront things directly, but I just don't think that that's enough. I don't think you can say all the things that they say about it, saying it does all this other stuff whilst it doesn't have any Indigenous people or talk about Indigenous culture in that. I just don't think that you can kind of say that. So why don't you just play the kind of death sequence and stuff so you can get a bit of a feel for that. Yeah, sorry if I ruined the film for anyone there, but if you haven't seen it by now, you probably weren't going to see it, were you? you know, as I said before, that just looks like a fantasy to me. That doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with anything about Indigenous reconciliation or understanding that death occurred in the landscape. It just looks like, you know, a story, and not even necessarily a bad story, but nothing that's kind of contextualise in that way. But really what I was most interested in is the way that the film kind of constructs a landscape in a different way from the past. So that kind of is playing within what you would call kind of traditional conceptions of the landscape and the tradition of landscape film in Australia, you know, from a fairly long time ago. But the set of images in the film relating to mining, and there's a lot of them, but I might just go through a kind of series of those. The characters drive through giant piles of sulfur, then they drive to a mining site, which is full of machinery and infrastructure, then they view the destruction of the entire side of a hill. The film establishes mining machinery, infrastructure and destruction via human hands as being present in the land that the characters journey to, rather than being either coming with them or kind of not being present at all. The landscape's awe-inspiring because of the human activity and artifacts within it, not because of its natural beauty alone. I might just show you that clip now. That's the kind of first series of kind of visuals of the landscape represented in that way that I'd ever seen in an Australian film. I think there has been some films previous to that that have involved mining, but they've never involved such a heavy focus on all of the stuff that's there. They've usually been kind of human dramas about trouble that happens not, you know, on mines, but very much still in that tradition of you run into trouble when you get into the outback and it's a very uncivilized space where things can go wrong, not this place of kind of total kind of control where there's all of this huge piles of stuff and we're blowing stuff up and we're loving it and wearing safety glasses and what have you. And it's very different. The way Gibson describes landscape kind of film that's involved that in the past is that he writes that the legends of the awesome land imply that society cannot be seen to be directing the environment in its own interests. And I think that that's a very different kind of conception from the one that he writes about. The next act in the plot is to have Sandy and Hiramitsu spend a very safe and almost inconceivable night in the desert. And this scene here is essentially just as they're kind of escaping that particular night in the desert. Now, basically what happens is they get bogged and then they kind of try for a little while to get out of the bog. Then they just decide they're going to spend the night in the middle of the desert. Then the next morning, magically, they get out of the bog. And you're kind of like, if I was going to spend a night in the desert, I would have done that the night before. I wouldn't have spent the night in the desert in the first place. It's a plot device, right? And fine, whatever. You want to use a plot device to have people kind of sleeping in the ochre red sand, you know, as they fall in love. That's great. But it's not exactly a dangerous place. It's a place where you're having a love affair, right? It's a really different conception of the landscape as a place that you kind of get stuck in, you die in, or whatever. You know, this is just like a little jaunt. And then the clip that I'm going to show you after their kind of escape is they journey in a four-wheel drive, like a Hertz Hire four-wheel drive, of all things, clearly marked on the back for some kind of corporate sponsorship, I'm sure. But through all these urbanised kind of spaces, service stations, they go on a boat ride, they're in a hotel, And they're constantly kind of interjecting on their presence or experience of the outback as they kind of travel through it. So in my view, it's a huge departure from the traditional idea of the landscape as a place that's journeyed into at great risk. So I'll play that now and we'll... Anyway, that's a literal... I just cut sequences. That's actually literally the scenes that they go through. Those are the environments that they travel through on an outback adventure. Not really, as far as as far as I can see. But after that scene, like that scene just there is literally after that, that's when they go for a swim in the waterhole and it all kind of falls apart. But look, in my view, the compartmentalised space created by the journey... The tragic but what I'd call kind of quite commonplace death of Hiramitsu, like, you know, he's diving off a thing. It's not very nice, but it's not exactly some grand adventure or anything like that. That represent a direct departure from what would be the landscape tradition up to that point in time. The traditional and the new kind of collide in Japanese story, so there's still elements of that older kind of conception of it in the film, which I think I went through at the start, but... it represents a conception of the landscape that marks the beginning of a new cultural mythology, I think, relating to the mining boom. Now, Red Dog is a fully, kind of a much more fully developed example of this mythology, and it contains little, if any, of the traditional conception of the desert landscape. So I decided whether I was going to show stuff first or last night. So I might just do a bit of a preamble of some images of Red Dog, but the stuff to kind of... I guess consider, if you wish to, is just thinking about the construction of the image and how what's present in the image of the landscape, what is kind of focused on in terms of the narrative and the stories that's being told, and then also in some of these scenes, just a little bit about the way that it treats other cultures, because in my view, it's, you know... It's pretty interesting. But for those of you who haven't seen it, which is most of you, it's about a real-life dog, and it's actually a Louis de Bernier novel, which is actually really, like, it's a little novella, but it's a great little novella that he wrote about this dog when he was travelling in that part of Western Australia. The dog's real. There's a statue of the dog in Dampier. But I guess, yeah, I'll show the scenes first and then I'll just kind of go through my kind of... views on all of them.
That's Carter.
It could go on. But just gives you a bit of an idea. I mean, look, I just feel like it's pretty racist, to be honest with you. Like, it really bothers me. so many parts of that, like the bit that I love the best is the ski patrol. I'm like, are you serious? And a lot of people kind of no one's done a huge analysis of the film or that particular chapter of Australia's history as being somehow kind of different. So I'm not contesting anyone else's kind of analysis of it when I say that it's a little bit racist. It's kind of got no Indigenous characters in it whatsoever. But when people do kind of talk about that and other kind of Australian films around these things, it's almost like they just congratulate the presence of some kind of acknowledgement of multiculturalism in an Australian film as being acceptable and showing that we're all kind of getting along and everything's great. And I think that derogatory kind of... you know, like Vanno, the Italian character, speaks broken English like a child for the entire movie. Like, it's like it just doesn't change, you know. It's very silly. But I guess also in that first kind of sequence, I guess there's two parts of that. It's kind of a nice 10 minutes or so because the first bit that you get is the landscape kind of focus and the entry into Dampier, which is all of the shots of the landscape is even the establishing shot is a car kind of driving across the middle of a road through. It's not some kind of outward-looking vision. And then after that initial kind of introduction, it's all very, you know, not looking out. It's actually looking in or looking at what's happening. I guess, you know, in the way that you kind of... if you were going to sum up the miners once they arrive, apart from the kind of multicultural stuff and the absence of an Indigenous presence, the miners are all there to make money or get away from something. Later in the film, one of them asserts that we're somebody that lives and breathes this vastness and desolation, but in reality they work on industrial sites, they live in houses owned by the company, they're members of unions. The scene up here is just about how the unions have decided that Vano can't talk about his hometown anymore. And they spend their leisure time barbecuing on the beach and drinking, which is not exactly activities that sit outside of suburban Australian social life of the period. So in that way, I think there's a whole lot of similarities in the way that both Japanese story and Red Dog and the mining kind of mythology in general actually kind of compartmentalises or transplants suburban Australian culture and kind of society into that environment. So it's a very different kind of story. So let's see what else I've got from Japanese Red Dog, if there's anything else I want to show. But look, basically, there's one other sequence I just want to show very briefly, which is just later in the film. But basically, Red Dog's master dies in the film, and Red Dog spends a whole bunch of time looking for him. Also, Red Dog's master is an American kind of actor brought in from overseas, which is a fairly kind of traditional, kind of, like the way that Americans are used in Australian film, particularly commercially successful Australian film. I don't know if anyone remembers The Man from Snowy River and Kirk Douglas inexplicably showing up as a kind of beef farmer in a Banjo Patterson poem, but that in itself is another stereotype entirely. But I'll just show you this little sequence of this the journey, basically.
And this is how he became famous. This is how he became a pilgrim wanderer.
That sequence goes on for a little bit longer, but I think you get the idea. You know, there's one thing that I really like is this kind of the cartographic kind of dissection of the landscape. So he's running across the land and there's kind of this map of him kind of essentially dissecting what in older conceptions is kind of like a vast kind of empty space in the centre or kind of in the desert. So it's kind of that one, there's that kind of element to it. But then also just like the majority, probably 80 or 90% of the shots are kind of have some form of industrial, like they have power lines, or they have salt, or they have trucks or trains or something kind of going in them, which is kind of a visual establishment as of the space and the place as being very different from like a, you know, a vast unknown, unconquered, unknown place. But so this kind of gets to the crux of everything, and I'm almost done. Both Japanese story and Red Dog represent a diminution of the landscape as an obstacle and a playing field for the heroics of kind of that colonial Australian society. The film marks the beginning of a new cultural mythology relating to the mining boom that revitalises the early European utopian project of domination by productive use, which I think is the not quite forgotten project of Australian colonisation. So if I didn't talk about that at the start, that's essentially the idea that the American kind of Australia was very much considered in the same way that America was when it was first discovered as a place that might be a new world and a new place to kind of build an entirely new society. And the biggest part of the change in the cultural mythology that happened in the 19th and 20th century was that that wasn't going to happen, and that was where the mythology of the desert and the bush and other things kind of came out of. And so I genuinely think that these kinds of films and the mining industry itself is kind of tapping in quite well to this idea that there is actually some kind of productive use for, you know, economically productive use as opposed to culturally productive use for the Australian centre. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that. I just think that that's what these films kind of suggest. So just to plough a little bit into the kind of theory that underpins all of that and move away a little bit from the screen studies side, The Australian Legend is a book that was written in the 50s, I think, and it argues that colonial Australia created its identity from those elements that were most different from the British kind of roots that brought them there. So he talks about bush dwellers as being people who differed most graphically from the average Briton and so were seen as identifiably Australian, that this group has had an influence completely disproportionate to its numerical and economic strength on the attitudes of the whole Australian community. Now, I don't really care whether that's right, and there's been a hell of a lot of criticism of Russell Ward in terms of how he actually constructed this idea of the bush dweller, the bushman, the bush person, whatever, who was the quintessential Australian as opposed to the city kind of culture. But what's not really in any doubt is that that idea of Australianness then in the 20th century formulated, you know, what the government and what other people kind of pushed as the idea of Australianness onto people and what people were willing to accept. So I guess the book was successful in giving a large amount of cultural and political power to a particular set of traits accredited to a certain economic actor in bush-dwelling kind of pioneer kind of people. Now, Drew Cottle, who is wrote about the way that Ward's expressed identity has been embodied in popular Australian film, and that the book itself was and is enduringly popular with Australia's middle-class reading public, he suggests that the book and perhaps its ideas of Australianness were enduringly popular because Ward's legend gave them an anchoring myth about themselves, their habits and the ways to which new Australians must aspire. So it kind of set up an identity that could be offset against the challenges of new multicultural voices, Indigenous voices kind of coming in and attempting to influence national identity and the national kind of narrative. Now, just do a bit of a case study, and sometimes I think this case study is a bit kind of tried on, but I'll go through it anyway. This is a kind of political case study for me. So if you look at the events that occurred after the federal budget in 2010, you can explore the cultural, political and exaggerated economic power of mining in 21st century Australia. So Wayne Swan and Prime Minister Rudd launched a tax called the Resource to Super Profits Tax in that budget. The tax and the miners' heavy and successful galvanisation of public opinion against it, its role in the downfall of the Prime Minister and its subsequent revision show that mining wields significant political power. So why did the announcement experience such a severe political backlash? Mining represents a relatively small percentage of the Australian economy. It's about 6 to 10%. Its activities are 0.5% of the physical Australian landscape, so it's not something that's happening anywhere near everywhere. And most people aren't involved in, you know, mining is a highly automated kind of process these days, so people aren't mine workers and they don't have mines being built in their backyards. So why was it such a disproportionate reaction to what was a relatively simple kind of policy choice? I think that part of that lies in the disproportionate cultural power that certain parts of the Australian economy has had, you know, the relationship that they've had, such as with the bush dwellers, and that mining in the 21st century represents another disproportionate intersection between culture and the economy. So mining has this relationship with the earlier kind of productive use cultural mythology, which I think has given it a similar and a logical cachet with the Australian community that the industry has quite mercilessly exploited in terms of how it pushes itself and promotes itself to the Australian community. So economic activities necessarily bound up in the cultural mythology of the people who are engaging in it, individually or as a society. In some cases, that mythology will be closer to certain kinds of economic activity and result in reactions from the public that cannot be wholly explained by economic or political theory and commentary. And I think that it's a small but valid point that people who exist in economics and politics should pay a hell of a lot more attention to the kind of cultural knowledge that people like us all possess as they go about their kind of work. I don't think I need to conclude. Thanks.
Do you reckon some of the backlash to the mining tax is because it was registering it as something? Like, because it manages to go so well hidden and also be so kind of culturally relevant, but the mining tax brought it into the kind of public eye?
Look, as I said, I don't think it's perfect, but it just but there's a lot of other reasons why the government failed as well. I reckon that they had kind of utilised it quite effectively in the, around the global financial crisis. They had kind of taken a lot, like everyone was talking about the high Australian dollar in that period, the fact that the economy hadn't kind of tanked, and a lot of it was attributed to mining and the high price of ore and the fact that China was kind of booming. And I just think that the way that they culturally kind of packed it, like that stuff may well have been true, but the way that they culturally packaged it and represented it was also kind of very referential to a lot of other stuff that didn't really have anything to do with the economic arguments that would go along with it. So I think when they kind of launched this tax, I reckon the way people relate to stories kind of fundamentally relates to their own sense of security about their lives, you know? So if you're kind of white, middle-class Australian with a sense of identity that is kind of hinged in a kind of bit of a mix of this older kind of style of mythology with varied economic understandings, that economic actor is then starts being referential to that particular part of your identity, then someone comes out to you and tax it. And they say, no, you can't tax it, it'll destroy Australia. It's not really destroying Australia, it's also destroying a little part of yourself. Like emotional reactions are so kind of powerful in politics, like it's not often based on any kind of rational kind of decision making. So I think it's a lot more complex than the way I kind of outline it, but I just think that there was something. Like the way those stories are constructed, I think are all really referential, that they're referential to and they're kind of new iterations of that same very middle class, colonial, white, Australian, ridiculous notion of itself. And we should acknowledge that that still exists, because if you don't acknowledge it, then you just kind of fucking around. Basically.
I mean, I think the reason I was asking it that way is just because I find what you're saying really interesting about the way that the mines are, and mining as an industry is so pervasively kind of a big part of constructing our culture, yet those images of it there's not a lot of them. Like if you kind of try and call them as points of reference, the two films that you made today, even then they're kind of background, it's sort of strange.
I guess. Yeah, I mean they're background too. Like you mean the images are background in the movies
I mean for me, I guess I don't seek out that much information about mining, but no. I suppose but that's the thing, it just doesn't loom large in my brain, even though it does definitely come to mind in terms of like my cultural construction of Australia.
I guess Red Dog was like the number one. It's like in terms of box office, it's actually like number two or three ever in Australia, I think.
Yeah, it's like a huge.
I think it was maybe even number one. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not relative because Crocodile Dundee just beats it really by a million. But it's pretty close. So in that time, like my grandmother doesn't watch movies. She saw Red Dog. She hadn't seen a movie in 20 years or something. Mm-hmm. She saw Red Dog. And I guess those kind of, like, it depends who relates to it as well. So, I would never have seen Red Dog normally. I just saw it because I'd already written the Japanese story stuff and I knew that it was about mining, so I was like, I'll watch it. And then, when it was number one, I was like, well, now it's really kind of culturally relevant as well.
My brother-in-law, who has seen, like, 10 movies in his entire life, his favourite movie is Red Dog.
Different audiences, but
it's a very different audience.
I'm pretty sure Red Dog is my favorite film now, just from that, because it has a dog in it.
It has a dog in it,
and
which is a surefire hit.
Exactly. Yeah.
He loves Red Dog. I mean, granted, he is also he does fly out work at Mount Isa.
Mm.
So, like,
he does
fly out work.
Oh right, yeah.
Mount Isa. Actually, it's 300 kilometers west of Isa. If you can imagine what that looks like.
I think it definitely connects, like the Red Dog definitely connects to a wide kind of range of Australian audiences, except for an Indigenous one, because you have like this whole mining identity, and the fact that I think almost everyone at one point in their life probably knew somebody who was doing fly in, fly out work at a mine, right?
Everyone knows a miner, right?
Or if they didn't, then they knew somebody who like was thinking about doing it because it was good money. Like it was just like that discourse was around. But the other thing I think Red Dog really does is, and it's interesting, like your kind of racist reading of like the Ski Brothers and stuff like that. But I think it was probably powerful because it's the story of multicultural Australia as well. You know, like. And even though I didn't come out on a boat and didn't have to go and work in Outback Australia, that narrative of, like, my community's arrival is so much about being sent out to the bush and having to work in this, like, alien landscape for 3 years before they could, like, you know, return to society. And So I think that's probably why it also did so well, because it's like a massive part of it. I kind of crosses over many Australian narratives.
Look, I guess my kind of, without showing the whole film, it's hard to that's literally that sequence that you saw is like, that's the only, that literally is that little kind of roundup of all the characters. Apart from that, Vanno is the only one who features in the rest of the film. Like, the rest of it is completely all like this ridiculous love story between the American and this kind of, you know, tall, attractive, white Australian. And then, like, there's like a shot of like an Asian guy and an Indigenous guy on the bus. You know, and that's like, that's just it. And you're like, and I was just like, yeah, cool, totally. It's kind of like goes back to that, the first kind of author I mentioned who talks about the way that you can redefine and include, and that's great, and that's really good, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. So people may well connect with that as well, and like, so sure, absolutely, but is that still, is that like a great story? Like, how does that make, what kind of story does it tell about Australia where it's like, yeah, well, you know, it basically says, yeah, we're white, but there's some other people here a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? and that might, that, like, if you'd been completely cut out of any kind of national narrative up to that point, you might look at that and go, like, yes, I feel really included. And there's, like, there's lots of, like class in Australian film, I think, is the same as well. Like, I think that there's, like, I grew up in Western Sydney, and like there were films that were being made in the 90s that were really great about the Western suburbs, and I would see those movies, and it didn't matter that they were some of the most ridiculous, stereotypical representations of people. I was like, I recognise those people. I love that film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, yeah, I just being critical without necessarily saying there's no value. You know,
yeah.
At the same time.
But it's so true. Like, all I needed was the fact that they mentioned Laughing, and I'm like, done, best film ever.
Sold.
Next.
I knew you'd like that.
Yeah.
I also think the mining mythology plays into like Australian culture's obsession with class mobility.
Yeah.
Like every freaking thing from like the block to that stupid bib show is like obsessed with class mobility in Australia. Like any way to like jump over a class is like ideal, and I think the mining mythology really plays into that. It gives it a, and more than that, it gives a path to class mobility that isn't based on education.
Yeah.
And it's weird because it's kind of almost like you were saying earlier, that looking to the outback as a way of distancing, like a way of colonialists distancing themselves from Britain. But in a way, like this whole class mobility thing, to me at least, seems like a reformation of that British heritage.
Oh yeah, so it's
like
so obsessed with being classless that it's like just obsessed with class.
Yeah.
Gone around the other way.
It's like it's come all the way back around again.
Yeah.
Like you can't get, it's weird.
Yeah, and like the mining camp is a kind of classless space where everyone's paying $200,000 a year.
They live in a shipping container.
But also it's like a sort of like a mining town is like a almost like a constructed space where like all these people just come in and like no one's actually from there.
And like I think I read another kind of article about it that I don't know if it's been published yet, but like the history of Western Australian kind of mining in that period of time is actually like another, like historically, that area was almost completely left alone by white people up until the 60s, and then all these miners came in, and it's like actually like another kind of indigenous kind of genocide and dispossession that actually happened 40 years ago that no one wants to talk about because it's still kind of so present. And I think that the book is a little bit more kind of acknowledges that a little bit more, but I mean like Lang Hancock and these people who are like supposedly heroes of our economic kind of revolution were like saying that Indigenous people should be rounded up and sterilised 25 years ago, which is pretty intense to be part of the, you know. And I just think it, I the main reason I kind of wanted to do the research was just because it's important to acknowledge that those spirits perhaps are still very popular and very relatable, even if they're not quite so direct as that. They're there and very direct. Parts of 21st century Australian kind of, it might not be the government's kind of official narrative of the country, but it's the narrative that the country seems to kind of want to connect with in some way, shape, or form, and that is not great, I think. But, you know.
I suppose the stuff you had to say about like popular films is really interesting, because I come from a working class family, so like they've all seen The Dish and like Red Dog and The Castle, but like they definitely haven't seen Japanese Story. Like, and I'm interested how like something like Bring Me Day, like, which is like a, from what I can tell, a fairly popular film, but you know, had Aboriginal protagonists and was a musical. How does that sort of fit into that sort of like your sort of discussion of that?
I'll make an assumption. So I'm pretty sure Brand New Day wasn't that popular.
Okay.
It was like popular-ish. It's kind of about.
Okay, great.
Japanese.
I'm assuming it's based on the fact
that
my mother has seen it.
Yeah, it's probably more popular than any other, like, indigenous narrative.
Yeah.
I think it's popular amongst, like, people who watch Australian films, but...
Because my mum doesn't watch Australian films.
Oh, okay.
That's why I... Yeah, granted, I'm making a huge assumption here.
Yeah. I'm making an assumption that it wasn't that popular, but I just don't think it was. Like, I spent a lot of time looking at the top.
You would know.
The Screen Australia lists, and it's not, like... You've always got to kind of be a bit careful, because it's obviously they don't weight it against release date and stuff like that, so you've got to kind of use a little bit of funny maths when you're kind of working it out. But I think it's because it was so recent, it's a bit further up the list, but it's still nowhere near.
Okay, what about something like The Sapphires? That was hugely popular, right?
I know more people who saw Brand New Day than The Sapphires.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that both of those ones are always the characters in James Cautious the other, just last week, we were, both of those were brought up and dismissed as examples of Indigenous films.
Okay.
Because they both are so much about white narratives.
Oh, yeah.
And how, whether that could possibly constitute an Indigenous film. I think, I guess, as a separate genre rather than, like, Indigenous, like, as a non-country-specific category, was a thing that we were throwing into contention.
Well, yeah, compared to these two films, just having Indigenous characters seems like a weird...
Yeah. No, I mean, but then, like, Rolf D. Hughes films are definitely...
Yeah.
And that's shit, because there are some things. Charlie's Country is, like, fantastic, uncultural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Ten Canoes is good.
Have you seen Charlie's Country?
No, it was slow.
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
I reckon it's better. But I'm not necessarily totally in love with Rob here, but I thought Charlie's Country was like, because it's set in the present day and it's kind of from an Indigenous person's perspective dealing with the intervention. It's amazing. Kind of like, basically, the perspective it kind of gives you is, why do I give a fuck about the Australian government and then tell me what to do? This is my land. I just do whatever I want. It's pretty interesting.
So why did you... You mentioned earlier that you didn't like Rubber Group Friends.
Yeah.
Why? What are your reasons for this?
It uses Kenneth Branagh as a mediator between white Australians and the perpetration of the stolen generation.
Yeah.
It only portrays...
But is that because he's British?
He's British.
Yeah, okay.
And he's recognised by the British actor. Well, which most people would have been aware of at the time.
Yeah.
But he's also actually, like, he's a British character in the story. There's not very many other white characters, and then there's one white character in the film who's, like, the guard who takes the girls away, and it's like, I don't like doing this. I just have to do it, because it's government policy, and it's almost like, it allows this, it's like a transference for the audience to kind of... If you're a white Australian, you might possibly be feeling guilty for the policies that your government had implemented very, in the very recent past. It gives you this really unique character to kind of slide into and say, that's what I would have done. I would have been the guy who didn't want to do it. And then it would have only been the evil English bureaucrat who was actually implementing it. So then once again, you're kind of removed from actually having to bear any kind of responsibility in that sense. And they could have very easily kind of included, you know, like then Chifley refused to recognise Indigenous people at Parliament House in 1945 when he was Prime Minister. And he's apparently one of the leading lights of Australian progressive politics. We just have this huge history of racism in our government from all sides that just wasn't really acknowledged in the film. And it's fairly superficial. It's a film that doesn't really confront, you know, like there's like the big stereotypical kind of sexual predator character in the film in the middle who kind of rapes her character. And it's just all, you know, there's not a lot of responsibility taken. It's more about their journey through adversity without actually kind of, or the stereotype of the Catholic Church mission thing, which was already an established stereotype of something that was separate from the society that was kind of doing it as well. So you're a Christian, you're British, or you were sympathetic, and those were the people who were involved in it, but nobody else kind of was. Whereas there's other films that have done it better, like The Trap is pretty good.
Yeah. But, like, it's interesting, because I've seen Red Brick Fence. Again, like, it's another example of a kind of popular film, rather than, like, say, Rolf de Hill, which, I don't know, I was just thinking about, like, national cinemas in general. Like, to what extent do you have to sacrifice some aspect of the truth of your own national, like, heritage or culture to be able to reach a broader audience? Do you know what I mean? Like, even, like, thinking about Latvian films, right? There are Latvian films, and then people are going to watch in Latvia. And then there are transnational Latvian films that will get spread around at festivals. And if it means sacrificing a part of your culture to be able to disseminate some part of your culture beyond kind of your own cultural boundaries, like, is it worth it? Do you know what I mean? I just kind of wonder.
Oh.
There's always, you know, discussions that they're not indigenous films, and there's so many, like, issues with it, but perhaps it's simply a good thing that a white Australian is seeing an indigenous character on screen. You know, and especially perhaps a person who isn't into film, like, from, like, a working class family. I don't know.
And ultimately, film is a commercial art
film. Yeah.
Like, we need both.
Yeah.
We need the film that 50 people see, and we need the blockbuster.
Buses, yeah.
I guess we wrote a group of fans. Part of that box office success was the fact that every school student in New South Wales, at least, I don't know about the others, they were told, they were sent to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember what you guys were.
I never thought. Well, maybe. No, I
don't think I was. I don't think it's not a question that I'm trying to come on one side or the other of, you know what I mean? Because I think that. The Australian film industry pumps far too much money into films that A, fail, and B, have absolutely no cultural, you know, like at least the Indigenous unit of Screen Australia makes some really good films. It doesn't really matter if no one's watching them, they're really powerful, and I can imagine that the Indigenous communities are watching them, like, really powerful compared to how I might interact with them. So commerce doesn't necessarily matter in that sense. But the most popular, like, I mean, Rubber Proof Fence is by, like, Brandy J. Rabbit Prevention and Sapphires combined wouldn't have the box office of other Australian.
Yes,
they wouldn't come close to it.
Red Dog, yeah.
How does something like Bait 3D factor in?
That is.
You don't even know what that is?
Was it Bait?
Bait 3D.
No.
It's like a shark movie. It's like, it was made in Australia.
Not like a shark movie.
It is a shark movie, sorry. It's not like a shark movie. It is a shark movie.
Quintessentially.
It's all like, it's, you know, a rip and tear slasher like film that made like $1 billion in China.
It's pretty
good.
It's essentially the same premise as Sharknado.
Yeah, okay.
But it was a wave into a mall.
I thought it was like Reef. Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Is that called Bait 3D? I thought it was called Reef or something.
No.
The mall. I know that.
Yeah, like, I'm just, you know, because that's something that had a very small audience in Australia, but was like hugely popular overseas, and especially in the Asian market. Like, I mean, is that even really Australian cinema? Can we just disown it?
I'm pretty dumb. I don't like people say the Great Gatsby is Australian cinema. Like, get fucked. Are you kidding?
Yeah, well, it helps to bump up all the numbers.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, well, they invest in these films and they make them in Australia, so they do all the tax concessions. But it's like, it's the Great Gatsby, for Christ's sake. Like,
yes, we count Baz Luhrmann films as part of our cinema. We look really good, but
yeah,
right. I don't think
no,
we can.
But they did Screen Australia. Like,
do they count Mad Max, latest one? Because the post was done here, but nothing else was.
They filmed, because my brother worked on it, so they built all the cars and like did all the pre-production stuff here.
Oh, okay.
And they filmed part of it in Broken Hill, Broken Hill, the drought broke, and there was too much greenery in Broken Hill, so they had to, and they shipped it to Africa, the kind of poorest country.
Yeah,
it
was Morocco.
It's interesting that we could, like...
It was Nigeria, I can't remember, my brother would move with all the cars.
The way that the conversation becomes so much about, I mean, I think maybe the reason that the question of race is more charged with Australian cinema, I'm going to say, because what you were saying before, Clara, is interesting. Let me think of, like, with blaxploitation, that's exactly what happened, which was that when all of these African-American people started appearing on film, even though it was in incredibly derogatory and awful ways, it did pave the ways for some kind of later representation that is better. But it is interesting with Australian cinema because we have... And like so much about central narrative about understanding ourselves is that we don't get it yet. Is that like sense of no one really knows, or everyone has a very different understanding of what Australian cinema is. So maybe because it's still in that dynamic state of figuring it out, there's more of a responsibility towards making the films that get it right in the first place. And I suppose because we're so already self-conscious with it, like it's very bleeding edge. And also, it was funny. I do think with that sequence in Red Dog, it is kind of funny that it's not necessarily the like diaspora and the migrants that come to make a buck. It's, he says, I had a great life back home.
Yeah.
And then I just decided, whatever, I'll come to Australia. And then spends the entire time lamenting over the fact that he's not there, which is totally, in his mind, a voluntary decision. But yeah.
But it was the diaspora of white people.
Mm.
It's
yeah.
What Samira would call white people being racist against white people.
Well, why do you, like, it's interesting, like, why do you think they do that? Because there's this guy, Tony, can't remember his last name. He was in one of Chris Stender's earlier films called Blacktown, which is also really good, like, an amazing film. I don't hate Chris Stender at all, I think he's a great director. And he, like, makes, like, his social realism, which is awesome, about Blacktown, where I grew up, great. Really enjoyed the film. Central Indigenous character uses him as an extra in Red Dog, where he's like on the bus and he like sits down and you recognize him, like, oh, that's, you know, that's the actor. And then why didn't he get included in that sequence?
Yeah.
Why is it impossible to kind of say where an Indigenous person comes from in Australia? Because maybe the old man came from Sydney to work on the mines even though he was an Indigenous. But, you know, like, there's all
the Velvet joke doesn't work.
Yeah, well, that's right. Then the Velvet joke doesn't work. So, you know, that's like, there's an Indigenous person sitting down on the bus.
Kick!
You know, his mate got a couple of days, you know, back showing up on the set or whatever.
Oh, well, do you want to wrap?
Yeah,
shall we wrap up? Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.